taking their place in a long true line of everyday Americans,
helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors and have a few good friends. Every day you are everyday Americans.
Hello there, everyday Americans, and welcome to the Constitution Study. This is where we read, we study the Constitution, we teach the rising generation to be free, and I am so glad you could join me today. Today I have, well, I guess it's a slightly different take on things. How often have we talked about separation of powers? And do you truly understand not only the scope, but the purpose of separation of powers? How those separation of powers are legally defined within the Constitution of the United States, as well as the Constitution of many of our states? So let's take a look and see if we can get a good understanding of separation of powers. And then I want to look at some of the news articles to see how the breakdown of that separation of powers has become so dangerous to our republic. Now, we were all taught in school that government in America, governments are made up of three branches, and they are co-equal branches. We have three co-equal branches of government to act as checks and balances. Well, that's partially true. There are three branches of government, but if you read the Constitution, they're not equal. The separation of powers, what powers are given to which branch, are actually very important. Now, Article 1, Section 1 of the Constitution says that all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States. Now, legislative power is the power to make law. That means all power to make law is vested in Congress, and only in Congress. Think about that for a second with all the rules and regulations and other stuff coming out of the executive branch that has the force of law. When you have regulatory bodies coming up with laws that are punishable, they're effectively laws, well, that's a violation of the separation of powers, isn't it? Because all legislative power herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States. Furthermore, everybody who refers to an opinion of a federal court as a ruling or as settled law or as case law, well, is also violating the Constitution of the United States, because the courts cannot make law because all legislative power is vested in Congress. So that's the first branch. Of course, the second branch is the executive branch. We find in Article 2, Section 1, Clause 1, the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States. So if Congress makes the law, the president executes the law. That's the executive power. So if all the executive power of the United States is vested in a single person. Now, yes, this person can delegate this power to his cabinet and to other parts of the executive branch, but the actual power is vested in the president themselves. Now, if you look at the Constitution, you'll find that Article 1 is the longest article in the Constitution. It lists not only how the Congress works, but all the powers vested in it, including, you know, not only the power to legislate, but what they can legislate on, there's a whole litany. Section 8 has a whole list of powers delegated specifically to Congress. We look at the Article 2, the executive branch, we find that there's actually not that much that the president can do on their own, on his own. Yes, the president is the commander-in-chief, but it's Congress that sets the rules for the military. That's Article 1, Section 8. Yes, the president can nominate ambassadors, judges, and other officers, but he requires the advice and consent of the Senate. Yes, the president can sign treaties, but again, it requires the advice and consent of the Senate. So if you look at the powers that the president exercises all on his own, he has the power to pardon. He has the power to receive foreign dignitaries. He has the power to call a special emergency session of Congress, and he has the power to arbitrate a debate between the two houses about when they can go into recess. He can temporarily appoint someone during that recess, but that appointment is only temporary. And that's just about it. Oh, yeah, there are maybe a couple other things that I missed, but that's when we think of the powers of the president, mostly he's executing what Congress has done. So there's two branches. The third branch, the judiciary, is Article 3. The judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as a Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. So if Congress writes the laws and the president executes the laws, what is this judicial power that the Constitution refers to? Well, if you look at Webster's 1828 dictionary, a judiciary is that branch of government which is concerned in the trial and determination of controversies between parties and of criminal prosecutions. So the judicial power is about resolving controversies, to deal with controversies or to deal with criminal prosecutions. So the judicial power is not nearly the power we see exercised today, where the judiciary claims the authority to simply overrule Congress, president, states, whatever. But these three basic powers, creating laws, executing laws, and deciding controversies, are separated. And they're separated for, well, I believe, a very good reason. It's the divergence, the distribution of power to avoid corruption. The idea of checks and balances is normally where, you know, things come into play. So, for example, if Congress were to pass an unconstitutional law, well, they do it all the time, but so Congress passes an unconstitutional law, the president, as executing the laws of the United States, that includes the supreme law, the Constitution of the United States. That's a check. He can say, no, I can't do that. That's a violation of the Constitution. Or if they both go along, the court can look at this and say, well, no, this is a violation of the Constitution. And they're designed to be separated in an effort so that each branch would, I forget who said it, would jealously guard their power and not allow the other to usurp it. Now, sadly, what's happened is, many cases, you know, Congress has simply handed over their power to the executive, while at the same time the courts have assumed powers not delegated to them. We have not kept the checks and balances. So our three branches of government at the federal level are bleeding into each other. But you see, that's not the only separation of powers. See, we have this little thing called the 10th Amendment. And the 10th Amendment says that any power not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by to the states, remain with the states respectively or with the people. See, we have another separation of powers. If a power was delegated to the United States by the Constitution, that power resides in the federal government. If it was not delegated to the United States, but was also not prohibited to the states, well, then it is retained by the states. And if it was not delegated to the United States and it was prohibited by the Constitution to the states, then that power remains with the people. So we have three regions of government: the federal, the state, and the individual. And the separation between those three is just as important as the separation between the different branches of government. See, just as it's improper for the president or the courts to make law, it's also improper for the federal government to exercise a power not delegated to it by the United States. And just as the Constitution assumed the three branches of the federal government would fight to retain their own power, that the president would, or, you know, the Congress would not allow the president to assume powers, you know, legislative powers, or the courts to assume legislative powers. It assumed the states would not allow the federal government to assume state powers, and that the people would not allow the federal government or the states to assume the people's power. It was meant to be tension. It was meant for them to guard from the encroachments of others. So we see we don't simply have a separation of powers within government, but between governments. And it is this tension, this jealous guarding of an entity's powers that was supposed to prevent power from accumulating into small an area, either an individual or a group. In writing the Kentucky Resolution, which I haven't gotten a verification, there's some questions whether or not Jefferson wrote or not, but most people I've talked to do believe that Jefferson was at least part author of the Kentucky Resolution. One of the concerns he had was a consolidation of power in the federal government. He wrote that if those who administer the general government be permitted to transgress the limits fixed by that compact by a total disregard of the special delegation of powers therein contained, annihilation of the state governments and the erection upon their ruins of a general consolidated government will be the inevitable consequence. He went on a little later to say that the idea that the general government is the exclusive judge of the extent of the powers delegated to it stopped nothing short of despotism. This is the tension that's supposed to be between the states and the federal government. And this is the tension that has really broken down in this country over the last several decades. So now that we have a basic understanding of separation of powers, both within the federal government and between the different governments, let's take a look at a couple of news articles and see what where we stand as far as separation of powers, and what are some of the consequences of how we've allowed the separation of powers to deteriorate. First, we're going to look at a Supreme Court case, West Virginia versus the EPA. This case has grown, and it's a little bit convoluted, so I'll explain as best as I can, but see if you can follow this. In 2015, the Environmental Protection Agency unveiled what it referred to as the Clean Power Plan. It was designed as a step to curb carbon emissions in power plants. However, in 2016, the Supreme Court blocked implementation of that plan because, well, the plaintiffs, which included West Virginia, argued that the EPA had exceeded its congressional mandate under the Clean Air Act. See, Congress created a law. They created the EPA. They then created a law called the Clean Air Act, which gave authority to the EPA to issue rules to create a system for the reduction of emissions. So see what we have here. We have Congress delegating rulemaking capacity to the executive. They have Congress, rather than making a law that is a full law, they say, no, we're going to create this framework and we're going to let the executive branch finish writing the law. That's basically what they're saying. This is, we're not going to set the rules. We're going to let an agency, the executive branch, one that, by the way, is illegal because, well, let's face it, environmental protection is not a power delegated to the United States. We'll get there in a minute. So they have delegated that to the EPA. But of course, they set boundaries. Here's what you can do. And the court issued a stay upon the implementation in 2016 because they said that went beyond their authority delegated to them by Congress. Okay. Then you have, this was, again, started in 2015, 2016. We're still dealing with President Obama. Now we have President Trump comes in and he repeals the Clean Power Plan. Again, you have a president, you know, saying, "Oh, this doesn't matter anymore because, well, Congress created a law, but that rule was created by a regulatory agency, the details." So he repeals those details. You kind of notice how the president is legislating. So President Trump repeals the Clean Power Plan and institutes what he calls the Affordable Clean Energy Rule, ACE. Now, this had some looser restrictions and gave states the opportunity to set their own standards. Because we've already noted that environmental protection is not a power delegated to the United States. I have yet to find anything in the Constitution of the United States that turns the emissions of power plants or vehicles or anything like that as a federal issue. Now, whether or not it should be is a whole different question. My point is, this is not a power that's been delegated to the United States. Therefore, it's reserved to the states. But what do we see? We see Congress taking some of its legislative power, giving it to the executive. We now see the executive bouncing back and forth, and we have an executive, including both Democrats and Republicans, dictating to the states how they're going to handle certain emissions. And, oh, by the way, we have a president that was kind enough to give the states the opportunity to set their own standards. Notice that language. It gave the states the opportunity. It didn't say we stopped stealing opportunity from the states. This federal government stole those opportunities, and now it's giving them back to the states. So back to the case. The main difference, as I understand it, between the Clean Power Plan and the Affordable Clean Energy Rule is that the Affordable Clean Energy Rule adheres to the Clean Air Act passed by Congress, which the Clean Power Plan did not. So since this stays within the law passed by Congress, even though that is constitutionally dubious at best, at least the new rule is following the legislation. But then just days before President Trump left office, you have the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia vacating both the EPA's repeal of its plan and the ACE plan that followed it. So you have the court coming in saying, we don't like either of those plans. Now, I don't have the actual case, so I don't know what grounds they used to vacate both of these. But according to SCOTUS blog, the new administration, the Biden administration, was free to reinstate the Clean Power Plan if it wanted to. So whatever the District Court for D.C. basically said, no, you get to go back to the original Clean Power Plan. So now we have courts jumping in the middle of this saying a regulatory agency can't repeal its own rules, and a regulatory agency can't, especially with those that a Supreme Court has already put a stay on and then put in new rules. So what we have is an absolute quagmire of a mess, because we have the three branches fighting with each other it all started because Congress said, here, President, the EPA, you finish writing the legislation for us. And not surprisingly, it's still in the courts. See, after the Court of Appeals for D.C. Basically threw out, or supposedly threw out, vacated the EPA's repeal. They have no legal authority to do that. They could look at it and say, listen, the appeal didn't follow, or the repeal didn't follow the law. Now, maybe they did. I don't know. I don't have the actual opinion to see that. But now we have the courts, and it's still in the courts. West Virginia applied to the Supreme Court to hear a challenge to the appeals court's decision. But here's what I find interesting. This is a quote from Michelle Bloodworth, the president and CEO of the coal industry group America's Power. She said, regulations to control carbon dioxide emissions from coal-fired power plants should not be disruptive and should follow the plain language of the Clean Air Act. Again, where does Congress have the delegated authority to regulate carbon dioxide, period. They don't. And that's the crux of the matter. Congress tried to regulate something they're not authorized to regulate. Now, I will give them the benefit of the doubt that they did it for the right reasons. It's environmental protection. Most of us want clean air, clean water, clean lands, and we're okay with that. The problem is we never authorized the federal government to do this. We violated separation of powers when we let Congress create the EPA without constitutional authorization. We then further violated the separation of powers when we let Congress create a framework and expect the federal executive branch to finish writing the legislation. All legislative power belongs to Congress. Now, you can say, well, they didn't write legislation. They wrote rules. They're part of the law. So we're back to, okay, now we've got the executive. And we end up with all the nonsense in the executive branch. One administration does one thing. Another administration comes along, does something else. Another administration comes on. Every few years, you have this continual cycling of change because we're not dealing with legislation. We're dealing with bureaucrats. And then, of course, in the middle of all this, steps in the courts. And again, I don't have final judgment on the U.S. Court of the District Court for D.C. because I haven't read their opinion. But, and this is a big but, a court may look and say, listen, this regulation repeal violated the law. But to vacate the repeal, simply say, nope, we don't, this appeal didn't follow the law in our opinion, right? It's still their opinion. They don't have the authority to force the president to do something. To vacate a plan that did not violate the law, right? This smells, this has the stench of judicial activism. So while I don't have proof, and I will reserve final judgment, my concern is you have judicial activism. So now we have all three branches of the federal government fighting amongst themselves because they refuse to guard their own power. And they do so because we the people have hired members of Congress that do this. It was the representatives of the people and the states that created the EPA. That created the Clean Air Act, that created this morass that said, we're going to create an agency, we're going to let them finish writing, we're going to let them politicize this legislation. Let's face it, today all legislation is political, but now instead of being, okay, if you want to change this legislation, it must go through Congress, now all it takes is an executive order or an opinion from an administrative official, and voila, the rule of law crumbles because the law is shifting sand. It is constantly changing. And then you add the third branch of government saying, well, we don't like this part of the law, so we're going to vacate it. This is what happens when we don't understand the Constitution, when we don't understand the role of the different branches of government, and when we let them run amok without oversight. Because all of these machinations going on in the federal government are going on because not of simply a breakdown of separations of power within the federal government, but the separation of power between the states and the federal government. See, if we still abided by the Constitution and the 10th Amendment, the states would have looked at the EPA and said, sorry, Congress, we did not authorize you to create an EPA. We did not authorize you to regulate the environmental protection. We did not authorize you to regulate carbon dioxide emissions. Therefore, this legislation is null and void because we didn't authorize you to do this. It's a violation of the 10th Amendment, which supersedes anything you do, Congress, because the laws of the United States are only supreme if they are made pursuant to the Constitution. This is not made pursuant to the Constitution, therefore it's not supreme, therefore it does not count. But we've created vassal states. So now you have states and now even industry groups, rather than looking, saying, wait a second, what Congress is doing is unlawful, what the EPA is doing is unlawful, they're looking, saying, well, you know, Congress did pass a Clean Air Act. The fact that that act is unconstitutional doesn't appear to enter anyone's mind. Because we've lost this concept of separation of powers. The states no longer fight to defend their role. Oh, but 20 Republican states have filed suit. No, they've begged the federal government to protect them from the federal government. I'm not saying states should not get the opinion of the court. But as the entities that created the federal court system, right? Because the Supreme Court and all the inferior courts are creations of the Constitution, ratified by the states. The states are the part of that compact. They should get their opinion. I don't have a problem with that. But that doesn't mean that their opinion is always right. And it doesn't mean that their opinion is final. But the states don't know that, or they don't act that way, because we, the people, don't know that the federal courts are not the final arbiters of what is legal or what is constitutional. The states are. Now, I have to head out for a break, but before I do, please head over to constitutionstudy.com. You'll find all the work that we're doing there, the events I'm speaking at. You can ask a question. I want to do more Q&A sessions. Q&A sections in this program, but I'm not getting enough questions. So please, submit your question. Just go to constitutionstudy.com. You'll find the Ask a Question in the menu bar. Just check the box that says you want me to answer on the radio, and I will do it. I will collect them, and I will answer them all right here on the radio. I've talked about some of the classes I do. If you want to learn more about the classes I teach, go to constitutionscholars.com. You can sign up absolutely free. And you can find the classes I've worked on. Some of them you can take absolutely free. Some of them you do have to pay for. But you can find out more right there at constitutionscholars.com, including joining our ongoing Constitution study. We are going through the entire Constitution of the United States and the Declaration of Independence. We're doing an online study, and I won't speak for everyone else there. I'm enjoying it. I'm having fun. Even though I've been through this multiple times before, I still enjoy doing this. So please, again, constitutionstudy.com and constitutionscholars.com are where you can find out the work that we are doing here. Now, also, please head to healthycell.com. You know, we all really need to eat better. Most of us need dietary supplements, and many of us probably find taking pills a hassle. Healthy Cell has developed a system to nourish your body at the cellular level, to boost your immune system, to help you sleep better, help you focus better. And they do it without pills. It's a travel-ready gel pack, easy to use, easy to take. They have multiple different formulas. But, you know, if you're worried about your immune system, and let's face it, who's not worried about their immune system nowadays? Try their Immune Super Boost. It is designed to support your immune system with the nutrients it needs so that it can fight off any diseases. Not just the COVID, but the cold, the flu, the winter crud you may get. Give it a try. Immune Super Boost. I use it, especially when I travel. And as an America Out Loud listener, you get 20% off. So when you go to healthycell.com and you put your order together, use the code OUTLOUD at checkout. You get 20% off, and a Healthy Cell knows that you listen to America Out Loud. So again, go to healthycell.com, but whatever, you know, put your order together, make sure you use the code OUTLOUD at checkout, and they will give you 20% off your first order.
Each of us is born with 30 trillion cells that make us. These cells determine how we feel, perform, sleep, focus, and how long we live. And to live our best life, all we have to do is feed our cells. But most food and supplements don't reach our cells, keeping us from reaching our full potential. Make every cell count with Healthy Cell. Founded with a mission to empower people to take control of their own health at the most fundamental level, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, world-renowned cell researcher and medical doctor, created supplements that work at the cellular level to boost immune health, sleep better, focus deeper, and stay younger longer. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of any product. And that's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
As Americans, we seek to form a more perfect union. To paraphrase Abraham Lincoln, we are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And God willing, we shall not perish from the earth. AmericaOutLoud.com. Liberty and justice for all.
It's time to rethink COVID disinfection. A study by Harvard, Drexel, and Virginia Tech concluded, we don't have a single documented case of COVID transmission through surfaces. The reality is that COVID spreads mainly through the air. Shared air is the problem, not shared surfaces. The solution is the Genesis Fogger, which uses natural HOCl to disinfect both air and surfaces simultaneously. It's perfect for home or business. NIH says HOCl may well be the disinfectant of choice for coronaviruses. There's nothing more natural or more effective. Genesis fogs at the precise particle size to combat COVID and other harmful pathogens. It's what's missing from your disinfecting protocol. Visit genesisfogger.com. America Out Loud listeners receive a 15% discount with promo code OUTLOUD at genesisfogger.com/outloud.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. You've rejoined the Constitution Study, and today we're talking about separation of powers. The separation of powers between the branch, not just between the branches of government, but between the different governments in our country. So we started off discussing and understanding what these separation of powers are, where they are based, and why they're so important. You went into an ongoing case. This has been going on for years now, involving the EPA, federal regulations, the abdication of Congress to actually write laws, the regulatory power granted by presidents, the meddling of the courts, and the fact that this keeps going on and on and on because, for the most part, the states, rather than telling the federal government, no, we did not tell you you could do this, beg the federal government to protect them from itself. The assumption that the Clean Air Act is valid because Congress passed it, never asking, did Congress have the authority to pass it in the first place? So we dealt with a lot of that in the first half of the program. I want to take a look at a couple of other examples. This one actually continues the COVID-19 vaccine mandate, quote-unquote vaccine mandate, drama. You see, the Navy was basically ignoring religious exemptions. The Biden put in the military mandate, you know, all the military's got to get vaccinated, or I should say, injected with a medical experiment. There were many groups that sued to prevent that. Many members of the armed forces submitted religious exemptions. They said, this is a violation of our religious beliefs. According to court records back in January, by all accounts, it was theater. They did not approve any of those religious exemptions. It was a mess. So 35 members, mostly of them Navy SEALs, the court said, listen, you cannot separate them for refusing to participate in this medical experiment because you did not provide them a meaningful religious exemption. That therefore violating, the First Amendment, because this is federal government. So, yeah, the First Amendment does apply. They denied their freedom of religion. Well, back in February, President Biden, at least his administration, tried to get around part of it, tried to lift some of this, saying, well, at least let us put in the mandate for people being deployed. The administration argued that forcing the Navy to deploy plaintiffs while they are unvaccinated threatens the success of critical missions and needlessly endangers the health and safety of other service members. Now, we all know that's a lie. I mean, we've seen it. The vaccine does not prevent the infection of Omicron. It does not prevent infection long-term, period. It at best may mitigate some symptoms, but even that is a waning protection. So it is not a vaccine by legal definition. It does not prevent the catching of COVID. It does not prevent the spreading of COVID. At best, it is gene therapy meant to mitigate some of the symptoms of COVID, which means how does that threaten the success of critical missions overseas? What threatens the success of critical missions overseas is the Biden administration's continued detaching of military personnel for their unwillingness to be medical guinea pigs. So here we have a disagreement between, in effect, parts of the executive branch, right? You've got the President of the United States, his administration, that has put forth this order. You have members of the military who have said that violates our rights. And now we have a court system, the judicial system. Its purpose is to try controversies. It is trying this controversy. And that is the proper role. This is a good example of the separation of powers, where to date, at least, a court has not ordered the president or his administration to do something. But the court has said, listen, we are still looking at this. Therefore, we are saying you cannot separate these men and women until they've had their day in court and has gone through the proper legal system. So, sorry. And the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals continued this when the Biden administration wanted to say, well, at least lift the restrictions on mandates for those being deployed. And the Fifth Circuit said, no. It is an adversarial situation, and it's supposed to be an adversarial situation. The idea of separation of powers assumes some sort of rivalry. And the fact that so many Americans look for Congress and the president to be buddy buddies and in lockstep and do everything together is dangerous. But we see here it's the fact that there are members of the judiciary that are saying, no, you don't necessarily get what you want. That it is that separation that actually protects your rights, not just the rights of the 35 Navy members, but the rights of all Americans. The idea that there's an adversarial relationship between the three branches of government and between the different governments is what is the ultimate protection of your rights. It's one of the best ways that your rights are protected, is to have these groups arguing, pulling against each other, so that one group or one concept doesn't take over and steamroll over the rights of the American people. But of course, just as there are those who will support and defend the separation of powers, we have those that are more than willing to ignore and destroy the separation of powers. Well, take the recent example of Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib in her response to President Biden's State of the Union. See, she doesn't like that they haven't gotten their way. So she says President Biden can cancel federal student debt. He can ban federal fossil fuel leases and drilling. He can fix our labor rules. He can change how we calculate the poverty line. He can take all of these actions without Congress. In other words, she wants to take many of the features, the quote-unquote features of the Build Back Better bill that failed in Congress. And she wants the president to implement them, what, by executive order? See, this is the very antithesis of what our founding fathers had in mind. If Congress says no, it's not the role of the president to say yes. The very idea that a member of Congress says, well, if we can't do it ourselves, we'll get the other branch to do it for us, whether that branch be the president or, as has often happened, the judiciary. This centralizes power. This is why President Biden acts more like a king than he does a president, because we've invested so much power in the office of president that the temptation to simply act on your own without legal authority, without Congress, is there. Power corrupts. And we have placed so much power, we have allowed Congress to place so much power in the executive branch, both in the president directly and in the different executive agencies, those powers naturally corrupt. It's the nature of human beings. And here we have a representative of Congress saying, listen, if we can't do it, then the other branch should do it. In other words, rather than defending the powers of her branch of government, rather than saying, you know what, the people's representatives don't like this idea, how can we make it better? How can we make it something that they will allow, that the people, the American people will support, that they will go to their representatives and tell them to support this in majority numbers? How can we do that? No. She doesn't do that. Because for so many in the progressive movement, the ends justify the means. It doesn't matter how they get their will, just that they get their will. And the fact that a person like this not only holds that seat, but is likely to be reelected. Tell me, ladies and gentlemen of her district in Michigan, do you like the fact that even though Congress didn't do something, she was willing to make the president the king, give him kingly powers, princely powers, simply order to do things around? You know, the president doesn't have the United States doesn't have the authority to fund student loan debt. So the very idea that the federal government has student loan debt is criminal. It's a violation of the Constitution, much less allowing a president simply on his own write off millions of dollars of student loan debt. To take people who have borrowed money with the promise to pay it back and say, no, you don't have to. To buy off, to bribe millions of American people with a pen and a phone, to quote Obama. To put in the power, in one man's hand, the question of leasing and drilling lands for fuel. Or the ability to create plants. Put that all in the hands of one man. That is the antithesis of the separation of powers. To claim that the president alone can set labor rules or change the rules for overtime pay, to calculate the poverty line, to break up what some people call monopolies. That is the antithesis of the separation of powers. It is why billions of dollars are now spent on presidential elections. Because we have taken the power, the states have allowed the power to be taken from them and given to the United States, and then within the United States government, Congress has taken their power and given it to the president. That's why America looks less and less like a republic and more like an oligarchy, because not simply because people like Rashida Tlaib or AOC or Nancy Pelosi have promoted this, but because the American people have let it happen. Because we sat back while the government that was created for us, the government that protected our rights, has been corrupted. The idea of separation of powers, to make sure that too much power didn't reside in either one person or one body. The recognition of Lord Acton, that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts, tends to corrupt absolutely. Yet what do we see happening? We see the concentration of power, making power more and more absolute. And then we are shocked, I say, to find out that there are corrupt people that try to get control of that power. And that there are corrupt people that power not only corrupts the people in office, but the people who are accepting the gifts from that office. And that as power is centralized more and more, the level of corruption becomes more and more absolute. The genius behind the separation of powers that our founding fathers gave us is being wiped away. It's like, it's literally like getting one of those scratch-off lottery tickets and scratching off and finding out that you won, only to go in with a pen and change that ticket so that you lose. Why? I believe the answer has to do a lot with the fact that we are universally ignorant about our Constitution. Now, there's another article that came across it, and this one's a little different because I'm dealing much more at the state level this time. You see, in Mississippi, a bill was submitted for Mississippi to join an interstate compact between Mississippi, Arkansas, and Tennessee. And I looked at this, at the bill that was submitted, and the idea is, if you look at, there's a junction between northern Mississippi, western Tennessee, and eastern Arkansas, right around the city of Memphis. So what they wanted to do, these three states want to create this interstate compact to create a what they call a Region Smart Development Group. The development district, right? They want, instead of having each state doing its own thing, they want to create some quasi-governmental agency that will kind of regulate that whole area, that will look at the area as a whole, not simply within the state. We've seen it before. I grew up in New York City, and you have the Port Authority, right? Because the Port of New York, you've got New York and New Jersey. They both share the Hudson River. They basically share the entrance to the Hudson River. So they created a port authority to deal with issues that span both states. Right? Now, according to the Constitution, states, in order for states to enter into interstate compacts, it must be approved by Congress. So my first thought, the first thing I looked for with this when I saw it was, okay, is Congress involved? And I did a little quick looking through, and it's worded a little strange, but all the way down in Article 5 of this bill, it does say the approval by the states is not a condition precedent to consent by Congress. The states agree to use their best efforts to secure the consent of Congress to the extent such consent is deemed necessary to implement all the provisions of this compact. So they're saying, yeah, okay, we need Congress's approval. But it looks like they're saying, well, we sort of need it, and we only need it for certain areas, so they're going to limit it to that. So, okay, my first concern was dealt with. They're not completely writing off Congress. This interstate compact technically will not be valid unless and until Congress approves it. But then I started reading through the actual legislation. And the purpose of this district, this Region Smart District, is for improving the quality of life, promoting economic development, stimulating economic growth, minimizing unemployment, and promoting the general welfare for the benefits of the citizens of Arkansas, Mississippi, and Tennessee. Sounds wonderful. Sounds very wonderful. And it goes through and they create the Region Smart Development Group, the district, the agency, and it will be governed by a board with 15 members elected from the different districts and states and counties and yada yada, and they got all this interesting stuff. And I got down to the point where they talk about what powers does this Region Smart Development Group have? Well, they can develop amendment, marketing, and communication strategies. All right, that's not a big deal. They can contract with agencies to provide or receive services. They can apply for grants. They can charge fees for facilities they own. So right now we've got the understanding that this agency, this quasi-governmental entity, will apparently own land. It will receive contributions and monies from governmental and non-governmental agencies. It'll make plans for getting involved in the coordinations of streets, highways, parkways, parking areas, terminals, water supplies, and sewage and disposal works, recreational and conservation facilities and projects. Basically, they're going to work together to do all these things like a kind of like a super city almost. And if they're coordinating streets and highways and parkways and parking and terminals and all this, it sounds like they're going to act like a, like their own, almost like a city. Like a city around the city. So, of course, they're going to have employees and do all that other stuff. They're going to make recommendations to the different state legislatures or Congress to deal with things like, again, improving transportation, terminal, and economic development. They then go in and say, well, they're going to be able to exercise any additional powers conferred on it by the agreement of the legislatures of the states or by an act of Congress. So again, this is acting more and more like a governmental agency. But then I came down here and I noticed this little thing. All right, so they have they're going to be able to purchase, lease, or acquire by gift land. They're going to be able to plan, construct, maintain, and operate their own roads, bridges, tunnels, airports, ports, freight routes, and facilities. They are also going to be able to issue bonds and borrow money and all that fun and games. Where is it? And we get way down here. To exercise the power of eminent domain and condemnation over any and all rights or property of any kind or character necessary for the purpose of Region Smart Development, subject to the provisions of this compact, provided, however, that any decision by Region Smart Development to exercise its authority under this paragraph shall be specifically approved by the Board of Commissioners, with all members of the Board of those whose state the property is located voting in favor. The states wish to give this quasi-governmental agency that does not have an elected official in it. It is run by a board that is appointed by different governmental agencies. The power of eminent domain. Eminent domain is both it's a very powerful power. It is also an extremely dangerous power. Eminent domain is the ability of a governmental agency to basically come to your land and say, we need it for public use. We're going to buy it at what we consider to be a fair market price. Right? Fifth Amendment says that they have to, if they're going to take land for public use, they have to pay you a fair price for it. Of course, they also have the power to condemn your property, meaning to decrease its value. Now, you have three states that are talking about taking one of their most fearsome powers, the power of eminent domain, and handing it over to a bunch of unelected bureaucrats, at least for the counties in this development district. Does that sound like a violation of separation of powers to you? That disturbs me. I'm not real sanguine. Okay, I'm in Tennessee. Granted, I'm in Middle Tennessee, not Western Tennessee, not the Memphis area where this is happening. But this disturbs me. It disturbs me that you're talking about placing some of the most awesome powers of government into the hands of unelected bureaucrats. And in fact, I am already reaching out to my state representative saying, wait a second, what's wrong with this picture? This is an interstate compact of states giving up their power, in many ways, over parts of their state. And in doing so, handing a tremendous power to a group of unelected bureaucrats. Now, why would state legislators do that? Well, I'm not in their heads. I'm sure they got all this information. They sent all this data about how, it can do economic development and that will mean more tax revenue and we'll be able to do this wonderful thing and that wonderful thing. And we'll have pretty promenades and better airports and better roads and better bridges and all these wonderful things. Never asking the question, is it a power that was delegated to you by the people of your state? Is it a power best exercised by unelected bureaucrats? Is it a power that the state is willing to give up? Because one of the things this does is isolates the elected officials from the consequences of their decisions. You see, if you live in this new district should be formed, and the district decides that they want to put in a road, a bridge, a parking lot, a terminal, and they condemn your property, destroying its property value, then use the power of eminent domain to take over that property, paying you a fraction of what it was originally worth. The elected bureaucrats, the elected officials, I should say, the people we hire, well, they can wash their hands and say, not my fault, we didn't do it. We created this department to do it for us. See, the separation of powers without accountability is inherently dangerous. Now, what can we do about all these issues? Not just this one, all these issues. Number one, we need to be in communication with our elected officials. If the only time you think about your elected representative is when you show up at the ballot box, you're derelict in your duty. Need to be in contact, need to talk to them about any of these issues, and all of these issues in many cases. We need to hold them accountable and say, if you're not going to uphold the supreme law of the land, your oath of office to support the supreme law of your state and the supreme law of the land, then you're unworthy of that office. And they need to be replaced. I don't care if they're a donkey. I don't care if they're an elephant. I don't care if they're a unicorn. If they will not uphold their oath to support the Constitution of their state of the United States, they are unworthy of the office and they need to be replaced. And if it takes work to find someone better to replace them with, that is work worth doing. Because as the separation of powers is destroyed, so are your rights. So are your freedoms. So is your liberty. And ultimately, we have no one to blame but we the people. Because we have let our elected officials destroy one of the bulwarks of the protections of our rights, and we sat back and did nothing. Now, do me a favor. Make sure AmericaOutloud.com is your daily stop for all the latest news and happenings. It's more important than ever that we share these stories, these articles, the podcasts, the videos, so that we can help secure the blessings of liberty for ourselves and for every future American. Because if we won't do it, who will?
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors, and have a few good friends.